This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
You're listening to the Faith 2020 podcast, helping you see 2020 clearly through the lens of faith. Now here's your host, Michael Ware.
Hello, this is the Faith 2020 podcast. I'm your host, Michael Ware, here for another episode. Have a great guest for you this week, James Mumford. James is a scholar, a journalist, has a new book out called Vexed, and interested in telling you more about him. It's going to be, I think, a helpful episode that gives some good sort of intellectual infrastructure to support us as we head towards a general election. And also, James is writing and think about issues that are really close to the heart of many of you who are listening. And so I know that you'll appreciate James and what he has to share with us. It's been an interesting couple of weeks in the 2020 race. Let's just run through some of the developments. The vice president, former Vice President Biden's running mate search, like we discussed in the last episode, the vetting committee is set up, and we're seeing, both as, it's hard to. Hard to distinguish which are purely attempts to get free media based on speculation and which are actual vetting opportunities. But Joe Biden's been doing quite a few events, fundraisers, etc., with potential female running mates, from Stacey Abrams to Amy Klobuchar to Kamala Harris to Governor Whitmer. And so that's an interesting dynamic to see play out. But wisely, they're also, I think, doing this not just to, test the chemistry, see kind of if, if they're a good match, but also because it's a great way to get press. It's a great way to get people to tune in. The second interesting piece of what has happened over the last couple of weeks is increased reporting that Vice President Biden has changed his perspective on the race and on what's needed in response to coronavirus. New York Magazine came out with an article that suggested the Democratic nominee is now looking towards a FDR-sized presidency, and that more robust sort of economic intervention is going to be needed. And, I think it's important. We're seeing again, and this is a theme, all moves to the left are not equal. They don't all have the same political electoral implications. And so, I've seen a lot of commentary, some of which I share, let me tell you what I do share and what I don't. What I do think is this season of working on bringing the party together can't be the focus until the convention. We can't be focused internally just bringing the party together and then have, 12 weeks, 10 weeks to actually run a general election campaign and to reach out to people who aren't identified as Democrats. Strategically, I've been okay with setting up these policy working groups and speaking to Democrats and to the left and trying to show the progressive wing of the party that Joe Biden is going to listen to them. I think that's important. On the other hand, that was what the entire Democratic primary was about. Like we've had a year and a half of that. The Democratic Party is almost nothing but these candidates running around and doing the gauntlet of activist groups. And Joe Biden won that. And so that's where I think the criticism has a bit of merit, which is the idea that he won as a moderate doesn't make a whole lot of sense to, as you move into a general, move even further to the left. Where I disagree is, again, this idea any move to the left is the same as any other move to the left. an economic move to the left, which folks will remember the Obama re-election campaign made a significant move to a more populist economic message and emphasis in 2012. An economic move to the left has different electoral implications, has different coalitional implications than a move to the left on everything. And so we should be reporting on this as an economic move to the left. I have yet to see signs that Joe Biden has moved any further to the left on social issues, particularly issues traditionally associated with sort of religious outreach. We just haven't seen that yet. Maybe we will. I think that would be a mistake. I think the primary pulled him to the left more than it was helpful. We did see the Democratic nominee roll out a plan for Black America, as he's been rolling out plans for other communities. And there's a lot in there. It'll be interesting to see what sort of prioritization he gives to the myriad of sort of policy items there. So that is an emphasis of maybe a different kind. But let's use a bit more fine-grained analysis than just move to the left. I think that the conversation and needs in this country have moved to the left economically. When you have a Republican president and Republicans in Congress signing up for massive unemployment benefits, significant unemployment benefits, and direct payments to workers, yeah, that suggests these times are a bit different, might require something a bit different. The last thing I'd say is, with one or two exceptions, the polling that has come out continues to show former Vice President Biden in a strong position, both at the state level and obviously national polls, which will, you know, I think are helpful in some ways, but obviously we're paying more. As this race goes on, we'll pay closer and closer attention to state polls. And so I think Trump's going to be getting more desperate. And, you know, we're seeing that already. Jared Kushner sort of floating out there the idea that the election, when it happened, President Trump and Senator McConnell suggesting bringing President Obama sort of back into this and suggesting he needed to be called in for hearings. I have to say, in a sick kind of way, I almost made me feel a little nostalgic to see Mitch McConnell blaming President Obama for things. And so we're seeing that political card getting played already. I think there's been some wise reporting that has suggested that this was Senator McConnell's attempt to offer some disincentives for President Obama getting involved in this presidential election in a critical way. And gotta say, I don't think Senator McConnell is going to be scaring President Obama away from this one too much. And so those are some updates. That's where the race kind of is right now. And, you know, we're in a critical season right now. I do think the Biden campaign is probably eager to turn towards broader outreach, while it clearly valuing this season to bring the party together so that Democrats can head into the summer on strong footing. The Trump campaign, you know, I think has shown signs of picking up operationally, even if the fundamentals of this race aren't in their favor. We're in such a disruptive time, much like 2016, where things can change here. So I'd caution anybody who thinks that this race isn't going to have some twists and turns in it. All right, when I get back, I'm going to introduce our guest for this episode, James Mumford. This is the Faith 2020 Podcast.
This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Power Moves. Ignite your confidence and become a force. Written and narrated by best-selling author Sarah Jakes Roberts. Power Moves will show you how to open your eyes to the way that God sees you and awaken your boldness to affect change in the world by living out the truth of who God says you are with confidence. Power Moves is available everywhere audiobooks are sold. Visit thomasnelson.com/audio to learn more.
All right, we're back. This is the Faith 2020 Podcast. And I'm excited to have on James Mumford. James is a British author and journalist. He currently lives in London, but has spent many years in America, most recently in Charlottesville, Virginia, where he spent time at UVA. His book, Vexed: Ethics Beyond Political Tribes, came out in March 2020 in the UK. It's out in May in the United States. James writes on a range of subjects, ethical, political, literary, for publications on both sides of the Atlantic, like The Guardian, The Times, The Spectator, The Atlantic, The Daily Telegraph, Unheard, The American Conservative, and The Hedgehog Review, a favorite. From 2013 to 2017, Mumford worked and taught at UVA, where he remains a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. He was an undergraduate at Oxford, a Henry Fellow at Yale University, and received his DPhil back at Oxford in 2011. I think you'll enjoy this conversation with James about package ethics, and we'll get into what that is and how this all applies to 2020 and American presidential politics. Folks, enjoy the conversation with James Mumford. Well, James, welcome to the Faith 2020 podcast. So great to have you on.
Oh, it's wonderful to be on it. Thank you.
Well, I'd just love to open up. I've been looking to have you on the podcast for a while, especially when I learned that your book was coming out. Tell folks a little bit about your work. We'll talk about the book later, but just tell people about sort of how you got involved in thinking about politics.
Yes, sure. I suppose it started when I was a graduate student in America at Yale. And I did a political philosophy class, which intrigued me and infuriated me in equal measure. And I was sort of taught different things there by a very brilliant professor that I instinctively didn't like, but didn't know how to argue against. And that began a process of wanting to stay in academia to do a PhD, which I did back in Oxford, and then to go on to work at the University of Virginia, where I've been from 2013 to 2017, and was very much interested in the interface of moral questions with political ones. And I now live in back in the UK. Okay. And have jumped out of academia to be a writer, mainly because I feel that lots of academics don't always manage to pare down their material so that it can be digested by a normal, intelligent, but not specialized person. And that's what I'm trying to do with my work at the moment and being a writer.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you've, in March, you came out with this book, Vexed. And tell people about the book. Well, what's your aim here with this project?
Yeah, so the book was written when I was in Charlottesville and encountered polarization. And the book tries to tackle political polarization by rejecting the political tribalism that sees us packaging moral questions into bundles, into package deals, I call them. So I might be on the left and care deeply about the environment and I'm for affirmative action, and I might inherit, because of the way moral issues have been bundled together, a view about, say, why it would be sensible to legalize assisted suicide. Or on the right, I might have, you know, similar views, a different set of views that make me inherit a different set of positions. And so I was really interested in kind of pulling apart those packages and rethinking some of these crux, what President Obama called live rail moral issues, on their own terms. And that's what I tried to do in the book in successive chapters, three looking at package deals on the left, three chapters looking at package deals on the right.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a fascinating book. And I know, as you were talking about it, many of my listeners, their ears perked up, because we talk about these kinds of dynamics all the time, both here on this podcast, through the AND campaign organization I'm affiliated with. And it's why I wanted to bring you on. Where in the U.S., this is, I think, pressing in a number of ways. I'm interested in your view of how the two-party system plays into this, or do you think that this is sort of a transatlantic issue? Does a multi-party system really alleviate some of this, or is this just the way our politics is working right now?
It's a great question, and it's funny because, you know, I saw it as a I saw the platonic form of it, as I thought, in America when I was living in Charlottesville and seeing, you know, dinner parties where there wasn't any discussion because no one from the other side of the aisle had been invited, churches right. that were split down the middle, and in my university, faculty members who, because they were on the other side of the political aisle, were ostracized and mocked. And so when I got on the plane in 2017 to come home to Britain, I thought, you know, oh gosh, this will be a little bit of a relief. But, you know, when I came home, we just had this referendum, and it had spilt out into exactly the same kind of polarizing dynamics, even though we have, it's not as rigid the political system in terms of us having more parties. All of these same social effects of polarization were there. Families that were, you know, not talking to each other, people being defined and pigeonholed on a whole host of what they're supposed to think about different issues just because of whether they thought they were for Brexit or against Brexit. And so I think that was a real wake-up call.
Yeah. As voters in America approach this presidential election, and particularly among conservative to moderate evangelical and Catholic sort of circles, there was talk in 2016, and there are attempts to sort of impose the same kind of binary, the same kind of moral sort of weight to this election, particularly when it comes to consequences, policy consequences around an issue like abortion. I know you've spent quite a bit of time talking and thinking about both beginning of life issues. You wrote your first book was on some of those issues, but also in Vexed, you talk about, as you said, assisted suicide. How are these types of issues working their way through the American political system, and how do you think conversations about these kinds of issues could be improved?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Just as a comparison, you know, it's not nearly as it's not as political an issue in the UK. It's a sort of done deal. So, looking at the issue was brought me to my attention in America, and it was, you know, partly having encountered it at Yale. I think that there needs to be thinking about a continuum of how we think about respecting persons and how we think about protecting life across the board, and whether that includes before birth or after birth. And so I think that when we start thinking about protecting life as a continuum, suddenly some of these, you know, medical ethical issues that have for decades now divided the American public start to be seen as social justice issues. And social justice issues like immigration, for example, or gun violence, we start to see the links between those and what we want to say, perhaps about Catholics and many evangelicals would want to say about abortion. And so I think by having these issues in conversation with each other, we improve the nature of our dialogue about them and the nature of our thinking about them.
And it plays into the broader themes of polarization and as you describe them, kind of package ethics. And I'm interested. Did you study under James Hunter at UVA?
I was a postdoc, and we had many conversations. So I'd say he was my main point of reference there. Yes,
sure.
He wasn't formally my doctoral supervisor, but
got it.
I was very influenced by his thinking, and particularly the way that he structured Culture Wars, the book, because he looked at both sides as objectively as he could, and saw the same trends on both sides of the spectrum, which is what I try to do in Vexed.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and I was reminded of his work reading through your book. Do you have ideas about, or I know you do, share your ideas about how individual voters can, there are so many forces that are, package ethics just, it doesn't just happen. It's beneficial to political actors who benefit from being able to graft on to causes, other causes and other issues. As an individual voter, how can folks go about untangling some of these issues and feeling like they can participate in political life in a way that is authentic to who they are, as opposed to buying into these package ethics deals?
Absolutely. And that is the question. I tell the story in the book of how it was that President Nixon, somewhat cynically, went after, changed his position on abortion and went after the Catholic vote and ensured that lots of New Deal Catholic Democrats were transferred across to become Republicans on this issue, which did correspond also to the social liberalism of the Democratic Party in the 1960s. But, you're absolutely right that it's serving forces beyond the individual voter, and it's how politicians do business and how they build coalitions. And so in some ways, my book is an anti-political book in saying that I don't think the way that we go about making our decisions about what we do with our bodies and what we do with our wallets and how we think about those making their entrances and exits in the world should be dictated by these packages that have been put together by people in power. And so there's something about looking for dissenters, that it's a sort of call for dissent, the book. But in answer to your question, I think the individual voter has to, I think we need individual voters who are going to shape and create pressure for there to be a shakeup of which issues go with which. And I think that's where the energy needs to come, as well as, decisions that individual voters need to make about the character of the men and women they want to represent them, to be their leaders, and considerations such as that. But I think it's really an energy to pull apart these package deals that needs to come from the citizenry, and to shift the landscape that has come to be the way that it is.
Yeah, I think about these dynamics quite a bit. It's been a big part of my work. Part of the difficulty is that, it requires, I think, a particular kind of thinking, maybe even a particular kind of person to be able to sort of separate and draw back from some of these sort of imposed package ethics deals or this sort of fabricated sort of political ideology. Mm-hmm. But then in order to influence the political system, it requires actually buying into institutions. And so that seems to me to be the very crux of the problem when you get to the actual systems, which is the kinds of people who are dissatisfied with the current sort of structure of the political parties and the forces that they're currently sort of forced to make are often not the same kind of people who will invest in institutions and do the messy work of organizing when you don't always get to have 100% of your voice, even if you're pushing back against package ethics to work with other people to disrupt that system. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to sort of, you're going to have to deal with a certain level of disagreement. And that's just been a major problem. I point out in my book, all of the self-congratulatory language around political independence, they're disrupting the system, that they're showing the parties that they're not good enough. And, you know, I argue in my book that actually they're checking out of the system, that in America, we have the highest percentage of political independence in this country that we've ever had. And so you there are more political independents in this country than there are Democrats or Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so you'd think that if that was such a bold and effective approach, that that we'd see some change, but it seems like partisanship has only been entrenched since we've seen the rise of independence. And so talk to me about, do you think that there's actual hope for systemic change, or are you sort of suggesting that the real impetus is on individuals to sort of separate themselves from the system, even if it doesn't, you know, change the way things work?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic point and a great question. I mean, I think that there are institutional reforms that, you know, are pressing, like campaign or finance reform, that would transform some of the problems you're talking about. And Ezra Klein, you know, has written about this. And I think that, you know, the representation of those independents, you know, would change with dealing with the outside influence of certain players, you know, on the political system. I think that, you know, I've spent enough time with James Hunter to think about the institutions are important, and that being faithfully present in institutions as a religious people is a calling for many religious people. And so I'm not advocating the Benedict option in a sort of withdrawal from public life. I also think that these questions in public discourse are up for grabs. And so I write in the book about the importance of rejecting the easy solution of, you know, needing to disagree, learning to agree to disagree. And actually that it is very important to conduct arguments in a completely new spirit that honors the humanity of one's adversary. But those huge issues, those culture war issues, are still there to be reasoned about and to be debated, and they're still up for grabs, and public opinion is changing as younger voters come through and is changing on some of those big issues. And so I don't think a retreat from the institutions necessarily means, even if I was advocating it, a retreat from public discourse about the nature of the good and the nature and the resolution of some of these ethical quandaries that we face, you know, whether it be abortion or assisted suicide.
Yeah,
that's a convoluted answer to a very clear and well put question.
No, it's very helpful. You know, this is the Faith 2020 podcast, and you know, I do think our conversation has significant application that we won't be able to get to entirely in this episode. But I did want to ask you directly, sort of, how do you see some of the themes of Vexed and of your other work playing out in this upcoming presidential election in America?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, that this is a time for dissent against some of the package deal thinking that is, you know, that is going to emerge once again during this process of as this election takes place in such an astonishing moment in world history with the current, you know, health crisis. I think that I call in the book for moral imagination, by which I mean a certain kind of empathy, not just for those we disagree with, but for those who are affected by the decisions that we make. So whether it be the worker who is working every hour of the day and is unable through their manifold jobs to provide a sufficient income for their family, moral imagination is required for the sort of capitalism that we want to see by those who are in institutions, in business, and also in those who shape policy that affects the poorest workers. Yeah. And what we need to see is that moral imagination, which we've, I think, seen in this current health crisis, in the fact that there's a willingness to make sacrifices for the common good that has been seen in for the most part, the large majority's adherence to lockdown. And if we can draw on that strength and that residual moral imagination, as I call it, or willingness to make sacrifices for the common good, if we can draw on that, which we've shown that we can do, and we can apply those to some of these crux moral issues at the heart of our politics, I think there is hope that the landscape can be shifted and that we can reassess our options as we move forward into this presidential election.
Yeah, that's really well said. And I think a good note to end our conversation on. James, thank you so much for joining. Would urge listeners to go out and get... Or you don't even have to go out. You can order it from home. Don't go out, as a matter of fact. Stay home and order James Mumford's book, Vexed. James, how else could people learn more about your work and sort of stay up on what you're up to?
I have a website, jamesmumford.co.uk, where I post all of the articles that I write in the press. And that would be the best way of seeing the range of my work on other subjects as well.
That's fantastic. James, thank you again for joining and looking forward to staying in conversation.
Thank you. Huge privilege to be on the program.
Hope you enjoyed that conversation. I really like James. Appreciate his work and excited for what's to come from him. That's all we have this episode. Such a pleasure being with you. This is Michael Weir for the Faith 2020 podcast. Please stay safe. Stay well, take care of one another, and we'll talk to you soon.